allow this to happen. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communicate. This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Falling for prey at more than 1,000 feet under the surface, the scalloped hammerhead shark relies on a special oil in its liver to survive the crushing pressures of the deep sea. Shark liver oil, or squalene, is a fatty substance that provides vital buoyancy for this critically endangered species and many others. But it's also a lifesaver for humans as a boosting agent in vaccines, called an adjuvant, and improves the immune system and make vaccines more effective. Stay with us for an article penned by Justin Meneguzzi, a commentator and writer, under the heading, Why a COVID-19 Vaccine Could Further Imperil Deep Sea Sharks. Stay with us for more of Justin Meneguzzi's article. As the world's pharmaceutical companies scramble to create a vaccine for COVID-19, at least 5 of the 202 vaccine candidates rely on shark liver oil, or squalene, sourced from wild caught sharks. One candidate is a vaccine developed in Australia by the University of Queensland in partnership with the Australian biopharmaceutical company CSL and its subsidiary Seqirus. The as-yet-unnamed vaccine contains the squalene adjuvant, MF59, which is sourced from a variety of shark species. It entered human clinical trials earlier this year, and if successful, will result in an initial production of 51 million doses. Tens of millions of sharks are caught and traded internationally each year, both legally and illegally, the majority for their meat and fins, but roughly 3 million or more for their squalene, or shark liver oil. It takes the livers of between 2,500 and 3,000 sharks to extract about a ton of squalene. Conservationists fear that increased demand for shark liver oil or squalene for vaccines, among other uses, could further imperil shark species, a third of which are vulnerable to extinction. Stephanie Brendel, founder and executive director of Shark Allies, a conservation non-profit organization, says this is an unsustainable demand to place on a finite natural resource like sharks. Only about 1% of shark liver oil or squalene ends up in vaccines, and most goes into cosmetics such as sunscreens, skin creams, and moisturizers. Even so, as the global population booms, the need for vaccines will only increase in the coming years. Stephanie Brendel notes, adding that some medical experts suggest that people will require multiple doses of vaccines against COVID-19. Stephanie Brendel adds, "We're not saying that vaccine trials should stop, but if we keep viewing sharks as an easy solution and don't consider the alternatives that exist, then we'll just continue to use squalene as a template for vaccines." In light of the declining shark population, some biotechnology companies are looking for other sources of shark liver oil or squalene. Plants such as sugarcane, olives, amaranth seeds, and rice bran, for instance, all contain the substance. While plant-based alternatives are being tested in studies and clinical trials, regulatory agencies such as the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, have yet to approve them as part of a final vaccine product. For centuries, people have exploited shark liver oil for food and energy. Liver oil, for example, fueled streetlights across 18th century Europe. The oil has also long been used in textiles and food coloring, as well as cosmetic products. But it wasn't until 1997 that Chiron, a former biotechnology company that's since been acquired by Novartis, used squalene as an adjuvant in the Fluad influenza vaccine. Other major pharmaceutical companies began to rely on squalene for their seasonal flu and swine flu vaccines. While the overwhelming majority of sharks are unintentionally caught by large-scale fisheries pursuing tuna, squid and salmon, deficiencies in reporting mean it is difficult to disentangle legitimate bycatch from illegal fishing activities. The species of shark being traded is also rarely identified in trade records. To meet the demand for shark liver oil, a specialized industry of fishermen, producers and traders have developed, especially in Indonesia and in India. In a process dubbed livering, fishermen kill a shark to remove its liver, then throw the rest of the carcass overboard. In processing centers on land, the livers are minced, boiled, and placed in tanks, where they are put in a centrifuge to separate the oil from any residue. The shark liver oil is then packaged and shipped around the world. 1 ton of shark liver oil could be worth thousands of dollars, depending on its squalene content. In a 2014 report, the non-profit organization Wildlife Risk described a factory in southeastern China that was illegally processing 600 whale sharks, a protected species, and basking sharks a year. Though all sharks have squalene, fishermen target deep-sea species, which have the biggest livers and thus the highest concentrations of the oil. These sharks are especially vulnerable to overfishing because they mature slowly. Some take a decade to begin reproducing. As a result, nearly half of the 60 shark species most wanted for their livers, including the scalloped hammerhead shark, the long-fin mako shark, and the whale shark, are considered vulnerable to extinction by the International Union for Conservation of Nature, IUCN, the body that sets the conservation status of wild animals and plants. Many of those species are protected under the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora, or CITES, which restricts or bans fishing of certain marine species such as sharks and rays. Joanne Cleary, a spokesperson for Sequirus, which uses the squalene adjuvant MF59, told National Geographic that their squalene is sourced from shark species that aren't protected under CITES. In a follow-up request, Joanne Cleary did not say whether Sequoia's suppliers meet sustainable fishing standards set by the Marine Stewardship Council. According to Stephanie Brendel of Shark Allies, just because a fishery avoids protected species doesn't mean it's sustainable. Only a handful of species are legally protected, and getting a new one onto protection list takes years. Losing top marine predators such as the scalloped hammerhead shark could be disastrous for the environment, according to Austin Gallagher, a National Geographic explorer and chief scientist at Beneath the Waves, a Virginia-based shark conservation group. Sharks play a crucial role as the natural white blood cells of our oceans, Gallagher says. They keep our ecosystems robust by eating other animals that are sick, injured, or not fit to pass on their genes. They're agents of natural selection in the most poetic way. Stephanie Brendel, founder and executive director of Shark Allies, a conservation and non-profit organization, says the onus is on pharmaceutical companies to begin developing viable alternatives to shark squalene to present to regulators. She points out that Novavax, a vaccine development company, is already using an alternative squalene adjuvant, Matrix-M, in clinical trials for its experimental COVID-19 vaccine. Matrix-M is made from bark of the soapbark tree, which is abundant in Chile. Cleary, the Sequoia's spokesperson, says that at this stage, alternative squalenes have not been approved by regulators for use in vaccines due to the purity levels required. However, the Infectious Disease Research Institute found that pharmaceutical-grade squalene produced by a biotechnology company, Amyris, met and in some cases exceeded the safety and purity profiles of shark-based squalene, according to Chris Padden, Amyris's lead scientist. Amyris is banking on sugarcane as a solution to shark-based squalene, he says. In southeastern Brazil, the company is growing thousands of acres of bamboo-like sugarcane to be processed into squalene. Just 24 acres of sugarcane could, in theory, produce enough squalene to support 1 billion COVID-19 vaccines. Because growers can't control the way sugarcane is grown and harvested, it's possible to ensure the quality of the squalene, Padden says. When you use animal products, there are impurities that come with them because of the environment they're raised in and the places where they're processed. Furthermore, Padden says, growing sugarcane is also cheaper than catching sharks and removing their livers. Beneath the Waves, Gallagher adds, the pandemic has heightened public scrutiny of the vaccine development process and exactly what goes into our medicines. One of the other significant things that also has come out of this pandemic, he says, has been simply shining a light on the greater environmental issue at hand here, which is the significant loss of sharks from our oceans that is happening on a global scale.
Inside Israel.
Israeli anti-regime protesters continue their protests. They've been taken to the streets since the beginning of this year, demanding the resignation of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. They also want an end to his cabinet, and technically they want a fourth election, after three elections failed to yield any political change.
I'm here because I feel we have a corrupt and incompetent government and prime minister and political discourse that's very dividing, divisive and hateful, and we're led by criminals and we want to put an end to it and make a difference.
They cite a worsening economic situation, no real opposition, Netanyahu's corruption trial, and Netanyahu's growing power as their motives for their continued protests. They also cite the political deadlock and the unwillingness by the different political parties to compromise. These protesters disregarded regime lockdown orders and continue taking to the streets during Israel's second lockdown that ended in mid-October. They also defied an outright ban on protests, which they said were illegal. These anti-regime protesters say that nothing will stop them from taking to the streets unless the cabinet dissolves. Tens of thousands of Israelis have been taken to the streets in anti-regime protests. They've been doing so since the beginning of 2020. They have recently escalated. Israelis are having a tough time, and they want Netanyahu to resign and the cabinet to dissolve. Anti-regime protests have been taking place across Israel and in occupied territories. Israel witnessed regular demonstrations against the premier in defiance of a total ban on such rallies. The ban, signed off by the cabinet and approved by the Knesset, were purportedly introduced to contain the new coronavirus.
Protesting against our corrupt prime minister, we would like him to leave office immediately. He is driven by his criminal considerations. He is charged with very severe charges, and he should take care for his criminal acts, should deal with his lawyers, not while he's sitting in his office. All his actions are driven by his criminal considerations, by his legal considerations, and he doesn't do anything good for the country anymore.
But the protesters are budging. They say these protest bans had nothing to do with the virus, but rather to contain them from demonstrating daily. Trust in Netanyahu and his cabinet has fallen dramatically. A survey published by the nonpartisan Israel Democracy Institute reported that 73% of Israelis do not trust Netanyahu's handling of the coronavirus crisis. For these protesters, the gap between citizens whose lives have been so badly damaged and people who claim to be leaders but pat themselves to no end is just unbearable. They believe that the regime has completely detached itself from the people. Suffering and distress have increased all the while the regime in Israel has not offered any meaningful help, according to these protesters. Both Netanyahu and ministers from his right-wing Likud party have labeled the demonstrations as leftist protests and called their participants anarchists. This while members of the cabinet from the left wing demand that police do more to end the protests. Many have been arrested and injured in violent attacks by the police.
Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu is making laws that will try to weaken our protests. It's not comfortable for him that tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands are protesting outside his house. It's not comfortable. It doesn't look good. It puts a bad light on him. And he would rather that we will sit quietly at home. So instead of coming to him and coming to Jerusalem and coming to Caesarea, we are going everywhere around Israel where we can, where it's still close to our house, where it's still legal with the illegal, non-democratic laws that he is forcing. I think he is trying to ruin or to weaken his opposition. He's doing it with the lockdown. His lockdown doesn't have any sense economically, socially, and also health-wise. No logic. And again, the government itself, the people there, are not obeying their own laws. Also, Benjamin Netanyahu is not obeying what he says we must do. And it's a democracy. People are equal. It's not... we have kings and we have slaves. I can't promise, and no one can, that we'll get what we want. No one knows what will happen. We know what happened so far and we know what's happening now. We want a reform, we want a change. We don't want to see Benjamin Netanyahu in power, but it's not only him, it's also the rest of the government. And we want, again, we want an organization. If it's democracy, democracy. If it's a government, so it's a government that works for the people. We don't want people that are working for themselves and for the rich people and for the tycoons. We don't want a monopoly. We want a good society for everybody. It doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman, if you're Arab, Jewish, Christian, Muslim. We want a just society, a better society, and it is possible. And we want work, we want education, we want health. And
the protesters are on social media too. Gideon says, I really need to know why someone who has won successive elections and is propped up by his rival would walk because a few thousand people are chanting outside his house. Presumably, they voted Gantz anyway. Looks to me like they're going after the wrong guy. Sue sarcastically says, maybe all the unwanted ex-heads of state, including their families, Trump, et al., Netanyahu, Putin, can pool their stolen monies and buy a country to share and live in harmony. Shelley says this is why the indictment against Netanyahu is so inconvenient and unwarranted. If not for that, Netanyahu might have moved on. Now he has to hold Israel hostage to his politics to promote his personal survival. Democracy isn't supposed to work like this. Mariev says there is a mini civil war happening on the streets of Israel, with many incidents of far-right Israelis assaulting anti-Netanyahu protesters.
Tell you, listen, about the identity of the voters, I just already told you and answered that. But as for Mr. Gantz, indeed, you're right. There are hundreds of thousands of people who feel that voted been stolen by him, by John, and by the moves he did by joining Netanyahu. And he claimed to have done so solely because to protect the people, the public, and the state from Netanyahu. He said that his position as the government is to protect the public and the country from Mr. Netanyahu. But it's about to blow up, all this bubble. It's about to blow up because this government can't function. They really can't do it. So in the next days, we will see what's going to happen. I think we are going to the third elections.
Thousands Thousands of Israelis have participated in weekly demonstrations outside Netanyahu's official residence in Jerusalem Al-Quds for months, calling on the longtime prime minister to resign while on trial for corruption. Police reported clashes in over two dozen instances with the protesters in the capital Tel Aviv and occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds. One of the protest groups warned in a statement that the demonstrations were a warm-up for more intense protests to come. The marches have also been fueled by the regime's response to the pandemic. The economy has been devastated by the closures, and many of the protesters are young Israelis who have lost their jobs. Netanyahu's trial, the pandemic, and the plummeting economy are adding further pressure on his emergency cabinet, which was formed in May in partnership with his elections rival, Benny Gantz. Protesters are also upset that Gantz betrayed many of his supporters and did Netanyahu a favor by joining his regime. The so-called emergency cabinet was meant to address the COVID-19 crisis. It was formed by Israeli political parties after three inconclusive polls in less than a year. Instead, it has been plagued by non-stop infighting. Several ministers have resigned, including the health minister, tourism minister, and the housing minister, along with other senior officials from the finance ministry. They all agree that Israel is in a dangerous place.
I think much more than 73% or 79% don't trust Netanyahu. I think it's much more, even people who chose him, don't trust him anymore. And also, people are changing their mind. I think people understand he's not working for them, that he's lying, that he doesn't care. He's putting blame on other people that are working with them. He's putting blame on the public. It's not a serious man. He's not a serious politician. He's not representing us or anyone. He's helping his own friends. He's helping rich people to get richer out of the little resources we have in Israel. I don't think the sentiments are very fond of Netanyahu in the streets. Obviously, yes. Netanyahu is doing whatever he can to not get into jail, to not get off his seat, and to stay in power. And it's understandable. When you're a politician, many times you have a change in your moral system. Your values change. It happens to many people. I think Bibi Netanyahu is a good example to what happens. Machiavelli said it hundreds of years ago. It's a risk we have. We have the regular people, morals and values. And when people are in power, it changes. And it's very, very difficult for the regular person in the street to understand it. But I think here now it's obvious. The king is standing outside the pool, looking at us, and sorry to say it, pissing on us all. And laughing. Bibi Netanyahu needs to be judged for his crimes, and he's continuing to do crimes.
The protesters are on social media too. On Twitter, Free Logic says, "It's so beautiful to see Jews united against the Zionist-run regime. It's the only way for true peace and justice." Stefan says, "This protest happens to be at the site where Netanyahu held a rally in 1995 that many believe incited the murder of Yitzhak Rabin." Noga says, "The Black Flags estimates 170,000 Israelis stepped out to protest against the prime minister today. Week after week, for 18 consecutive weeks, thousands upon thousands of Israelis have taken to the streets to demonstrate against Netanyahu."
Thank you. Yeah, it is very clear that many people in Israel do not accept the authority of the regime, and it is not that difficult to understand why, because they regard the regime as extremely corrupted collective. This is totally obvious. I would assume that we see exactly the same thing in America. A lot of people within the left, for instance, or within the radical left or the anarchist left and Antifa and so on, are not willing to take, to obey the rules that are set by Donald Trump.
The severity of the protests have highlighted underlying issues. These weekly and now almost daily protests are against the violation of basic civil rights by the Israeli regime. These are mainstream Israelis who are taking to the streets and not Arabs, who comprise of 20% of the population, or minorities such as the Sudanese or Ethiopian communities. These are Israelis who are descendants of European settlers that first touched down in Palestine back in 1948 and occupied ever since. They feel that Israel has become a dictatorship. Protesters say the lockdowns, mass surveillance, and anti-democratic laws are more rife in Israel than ever before. Here's the news making the press in Israel. Ynet News. The Israeli army launched a large-scale military exercise which focuses on a potential war against Lebanon. The Israeli military said the drill, named Lethal Weapon, consists of regular and reserve duty forces, including the Israel Air Force, Navy, and Ground Forces, as well as the Intelligence Directorate, the Technological and Logistics Directorate, and the Cyber Defense Directorate. The Jerusalem Post. Hundreds of demonstrations have been taking place across Israel in continuing regular anti-Netanyahu protests that have thousands of participants angered over a variety of issues, ranging from regime mismanagement of the coronavirus pandemic to corruption proceeding against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the economic situation in Israel. The Times of Israel. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced Thursday that next week he will propose increasing fines for educational institutions operating in violation of virus lockdown measures after the reopening of some ultra-Orthodox schools and yeshivas in defiance of the regulations. I-24 News. Nearly 60,000 Israeli businesses could close by next year due to the devastating economic impact caused by the coronavirus pandemic, the Times of Israel reported. Citing a new report released by the analytics firm Dun & Bradstreet, the Times said some 55,000 to 60,000 businesses could see their doors shutter by next year, while another 40,000 new businesses are expected to open.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you. Amir Kabir. Khayyam. Maulana. Avicenna. Khwarizmi. Iranian Notables, Sources of Global Honor.
In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, in this episode you'll get more familiar with the Iranian poet who lived in 7th and 8th centuries AH, corresponding to 13th and 14th centuries AD. He was Seyf Faraghani. Seyf Faraghani has been known as a leader of socio-political poetry in Farsi language. The 7th and 8th centuries AH were among the bright eras of Iran's literary history, as masters of poetry and Gnosticism like Maulana, Sa'di and Hafez lived in that era. As we said, there is little known about the life and times of Saifuddin Abul Mahomed Muhammad Faraghani. Dr. Zabiullah Safa, who has edited his Divan or collection of poems, writes in the introduction, "Our whole information about him is restricted to the Divan of poems that has remained for us, as there is name or trace mentioned in the literary references and sources of this able poet. Although he had a high status in expression of mystic concepts and certainly has been one of the leaders of Khanqa, there is no trace of him in the Farsi books of the great figures of mysticism and Gnosticism." You heard that Saifuddin Abu Mahomed Muhammad Faraghani was born in Transoxiana and left his town Farghane for Asia Minor, current Turkey, in youth. He lived the rest of his life in Aksaray, a small town of the region. Dear listeners, you also heard that the Iranian society was so much chaotic due to the Mongol invasion that most of the literary figures and poets lived in fear and tried to survive. What one finds in the works of that era mirrors the pains and misery of people under the Mongol rule. The sufferings of masses were reflected as complaints in the works of poems and writers, or in the form of comedy and farce of poets such as Sa'di Shirazi and Obaid Zakani. There were three groups in the turbulent conditions of that era. The first group was the laymen, who didn't understand the causes of the existing conditions and just tolerated them. The second group consisted of politicians who had assimilated themselves with the rulers to preserve the worldly gains. But the third group comprised of responsible writers and men of letters who would either try to advise the ruling class or castigated them through satires and sarcasm. Most of the Iranian poets were among the critics of the Mongol rulers, who has in fact invaded the country and gained control of every affair through pillaging the resources of this vast land. Khajuye Kermani, who lived in late 8th century AH, depicted the circumstances of his era both directly and indirectly, Farsical language. He has beautifully described the situation of his era and the endless injustice of rulers, as well as the misery of the people, in an ode. خلق دیوانه و از مهنت دیوان دربند، وین عجبتر که ز دیوان زر دیوان طلبند. هر کجا سوخته‌ای بی سر و سامان یابند، وجه سیم سرزان بی سر و سامان طلبند. People are mad and chained in demon's yoke, yet strange as they seek gold from these folk. Once they get hold of a poor wretched man, they ask him to pay for the gold, what a joke. O Hadi Maraqi, the writer of the valuable book, Jam Jam, has mentioned the facts of his era in the form of preaching and admonition. A deep look at his book shows the depth of the people's distress under the rulers, statesmen, and guards. He points to the prevalence of oppression and widespread addiction to wine and hashish in society. The most vitriolic social criticism of the Mongol rule in Iran can be found in the works of Khaja Nizamuddin Obeid Zakani. He has lashed out at the miserable conditions of his time and introduced different social classes, especially the ruling class and politicians, in the format of interesting satires, sarcasms, and ironies. Critics believe that Obeid seriously suffered from the anomalies of his era and lambasted the ruling system with his caustic comedies. In his book, Akhlaq al-Ashraf, or Morals of Nobles, he has criticized the rulers of Mongol era very seriously. The very naming of the book is an irony of the ruler's disposition. He points to the corruption, hypocrisy, injustice, mendacity, and deception that were rampant in the ruling system. He vehemently blasts the Mongol rulers, especially Genghis Khan and Hulagu. Dear listeners, next time we will continue the discussion.
Around the world with reporters.
With Christmas right around the corner, retailers can only hope and pray the November lockdown is not extended beyond December 2nd. After the severe blow dealt it by the first lockdown, the British economy bounced back by 15.5% in the July to September period. But the worry is that it will shrink again over the winter months. Weak household spending is being blamed for the UK's poor GDP performances.
The unemployment rate in the UK is continuing to surge, and redundancy rates are at an all-time high. Millions of Britons are struggling to make ends meet, and millions more are saving their pennies for even rainier days.
I'm quite happy with what the Chancellor has done. Of course, everybody is, and everybody won't be when they talk about how to get these monies back. I mean, he's talked about cutting duty-free. People are complaining about that.
Concerned, very concerned about the younger people in particular, because of unemployment, because of the huge debt there's going to be. It's a massive, massive worry. And I don't think we've seen how bad it's going to be yet.
Yeah. I think the situation with Brexit and that is complete shambles. You know, this seems the government doesn't seem to have a grip on it, just as it doesn't seem to have a grip on the COVID epidemic. I mean, it's terribly worrying. I mean, I've got two sons, both who work in hospitality, and they're worried stiff about what's going to happen.
The extension of the furlough scheme might help encourage spending. The government will now be paying 80% of the salaries of workers retained by firms rather than fired until March. Britain's manufacturing sector will be getting a massive tax break extension as well. But according to the Bank of England, things will get worse before they get better. It predicts the UK's GDP could shrink by 2% in the October-December quarter, and its economy is likely to shrink by a record 11% in 2020, before growing by just 7% in 2021. But did the UK have this coming despite COVID-19?
The present situation started a year ago, last September, when the banks began to refuse to lend money to each other, and there was a panic in the banking system. Now, that is always the first sign of a coming huge economic collapse. It always happens about a year or two before the actual collapse. The debt levels have built up to be completely unrepayable. The rich-poor division has increased, and the type of jobs coming into existence due to the technological shift are now temporary and part-time.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson's Director of Communications, Lee Kane, has quit, and now his top advisor, Dominic Cummings, has left as well. Some say this will make for smoother Brexit talks, due to resume this week before an EU summit on Thursday. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The British Labour Party has found itself entangled in yet another racism crisis after a new report found huge levels of Islamophobia within the party. The report, commissioned by the newly formed Labour Muslim Network, suggests that current party leader Sir Keir Starmer has greatly lost the trust of his party's Muslim members. Just some of the damning results claim that
more than one in four Muslim members and supporters have experienced Islamophobia within party ranks. 59% say they do not feel well represented by the leadership. 55% claim they don't even trust the leadership to tackle Islamophobia effectively, while 46% feel the party doesn't represent the community effectively.
In response to the report, I reached out to British Muslims who have already decided to quit the party to ask why they felt they had to leave.
And from the people I've met, the counsellors I've experienced, the talking I've had, conversations, prior to even Keir Starmer's appointment, there was a problem within the Labour Party. Once he came into his position, it just reinforced everything that we were already saying that is happening and existing. And this was the reason for my exodus and the large exodus by my community.
The report, which interviewed hundreds of British Muslim members, added that some key policy issues create hurt amongst Muslims, including its stance on Israeli crimes in Palestine and Starmer's U-turn on Labour's Kashmir policy earlier this year.
Leave the Labour Party, cut off your cards, and let your friends and family know that this is what's happening, and Keir Starmer shouldn't be able to silently still get our vote and then still implement these ways. Labour is a failed system. Labour is a crumbling system, and Labour is not something that will represent us as British Muslims who live in the UK now. You know, it's just not. And Keir Starmer, I would sincerely hope that you would consider your position on the Kashmir issue.
Before Starmer took over, the party was rocked by the anti-Semitism crisis for many years. Some even argue it's what brought down the previous leadership. But the question is, will the response be the same to this blatant crisis of Islamophobia within the party? Many are arguing not. Robert Carter, London.
Once again, the violent clashes. The police tear gassed protesters to disperse them in Pakistan's garrison city of Rawalpindi near capital Islamabad. Nonetheless, a massive crowd emerged on the streets despite chilly weather conditions. At the heart of an intense public anger is the display of a blasphemous cartoons of the Prophet of the Islam by the French government on state-run buildings last month. Since then, there has been no let-up to the protest like this in Pakistan. The frequent publications, newspapers, and public display of anti-Islamic blasphemous cartoons have ignited an unprecedented scale of public resentment against France and its citizens in Pakistan. Protesters vowed to avenge the blasphemers of the Prophet of the Islam.
The honor of our Prophet is being insulted by the President of France. We demand the government official to kick out the ambassador of France right now from the Pakistan. Otherwise, these all people will protest. We will march in millions towards the embassy of France. We will march in millions, inshallah.
Being here in this weather, in this condition, against the government of France, against the officials, who they are not kicking the France ambassador from the Pakistan, why we are here to protect our respect of our holy prophet Muhammad Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam. No one can stop us to protect the our own religion, over the respect of our holy prophet Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam.
Pakistan's mainstream media largely opted to black out the coverage of this protest, allegedly under pressure to contain the agitation on this most sensitive issue. The organizers complain that their large number of protesters were arrested to prevent them to participate in the gathering. The government suspended all cell phone services and blocked all major highways to prevent the entry of angry protesters in the capital city. The extraordinary security measures have been undertaken to avert the repetition of violent clashes happened not far from French embassy in Islamabad in early this month. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
It seems the growing number of coronavirus infections and death has not yet sounded the alarm in Turkey's government offices to impose another lockdown in the country. The reluctance comes amid reports that the flow of tourists is still going strong in Turkey amid the pandemic, especially in its largest city of Istanbul, which has not only the highest number of tourists, but also the highest number of coronavirus infections and death. The city counts for about 40% of confirmed infected cases in Turkey. This number forced the mayor of Istanbul, Ekrem İmamoğlu, to call on the government to impose a total lockdown in the city for at least 2 to 3 weeks. However, his call was rejected.
When we look at the current data, it is obvious that a lockdown is absolutely necessary. I have shared this issue with all the authorities and people of Istanbul. I think a 2 to 3 week lockdown is necessary. This is highly advised by our scientists and experts.
Many believe that the government's decision is deeply rooted in its economic concerns. The government officials maintain that the closure of restaurants and public places at 10 p.m., along with social distancing and wearing masks, is enough to contain the virus.
The second wave of the coronavirus is spreading all over the world, and the situation is getting worse. Many governments may consider lockdown as an effective way to cope with the pandemic, but lockdown has its own consequences. Many people will lose their jobs, and it seems the Turkish government is now mainly concerned with the economic aspects of the lockdown.
Turkey's Cultural and Tourism Ministry announced last week that since the end of the last lockdown several months ago, the country has had 9.46 million visitors from various countries, including European ones, where the pandemic has hit the most. Those arriving to Turkey are not even being tested, which makes the spread of the virus even easier. Many here say Turkish government is favoring economy over public health. Now, the main question is how far the government may remain reluctant to meet the growing demands for lockdown as the country's coronavirus infections and death are getting out of control. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
The Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela has strongly rejected a round of one-year-long sanctions, fired by the European Union, which challenges the legitimacy of the upcoming legislative elections in the Latin American nation. Nicolas Maduro made the remarks after the EU's European Council condemned a decision by the Supreme Court of Venezuela to reshuffle the composition of the country's National Electoral Council. Maduro said the move by the European body is influenced by the regime change policy of the United States, which refuses to recognize Maduro's presidency and the country's legal institutions. The Venezuelan head of state said the elections will take place despite the economic sanctions because they follow the rule of the national constitution. Officials totally back Maduro's statement.
The EU sanctions are a violation of international law and therefore we absolutely repudiate them. From a different perspective, many opposition members justify the EU policy.
From a different perspective, many opposition members justify the EU policy. However, experts say the EU sanctions are unfounded and influenced by Washington.
The EU is mistaken in politically following the US meddlesome policy. The truth is, most political parties are running in these legislative elections.
Despite the aggression by the EU, the government of Venezuela says Maduro will go on as the country's president and parliamentary elections will be held this year because Venezuela is a free country and it won't be brought to its knees by foreign sanctions. Jesus Silva, Caracas.
In a somber silence, France marked 5 years since the November 15 attacks. 130 people were killed in what is the country's deadliest peacetime attack. Takfiri extremists linked to Daesh claimed responsibility for the attack as a response to France's military involvement in Syria and Iraq. Prime Minister Jean Castex led the commemorations as France finds itself in the midst of more Takfiri extremism and growing Islamophobia, polarizing the population. In the past few weeks, Takfiri extremists have killed 4 people after a series of Islamophobic statements from President Emmanuel Macron, as well as the overt promotion of blasphemous cartoons of Prophet Muhammad. Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan also condemned Macron's rhetoric.
Mecca, Medina, Asya.
It is an issue of honor for us to stand against the attacks against our Prophet who honored the entire world. The West are once again heading for a period of barbarity. France and Europe in general, they don't deserve the policies of Macron and those with similar mindsets that spread seeds of hate.
French Muslim leaders have condemned all forms of violence and have called for restraint. France is also calling for a crackdown of foreign funding that it says stokes extremist sentiments. But wide-ranging condemnation of the entire Muslim community by politicians has only deepened divisions. Yesterday, France hosted the Paris Peace Forum, where leaders discussed the ongoing threat of extremism.
No one can say when the pandemic will stop, nor when terrorism will be vanquished. So we cannot wait. We must lead the fight back and build structures that will allow us to better foresee these global threats.
The 2015 attacks shocked the world and damaged relations between communities. President Macron has since tried to dampen emotions, but France remains at a crossroads. Any further Islamophobic sentiments will only flame the tensions.
Trump and his fellow Republicans keep insisting that the U.S. presidential election was rigged, calling for a recount of ballots in several key states. Trump and his team have filed several lawsuits contesting the outcome of the election. However, they have suffered legal setbacks in 3 battleground states, namely Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Arizona. Courts there rejected Republicans' call for probing the vote count process and blocking mail-in ballots. Meanwhile, U.S. prosecutors have asked Attorney General William Barr to rescind a memo that instructed